Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Today we'd like to send a special thank you to the Danny Meyer Restaurant Group, Union Square Cafe, Gramercy Tavern, Maialino, and Untitled. Show your support at these restaurants by ordering one of the menu items featuring goat. Goat is the most eaten protein in the entire world, yet in the US we import most of our goat. Our dairy farms are forced to kill some male goats at birth because there's no market for them. Help make a change. Support No Goat Left Behind.
So if you didn't hear that, we're going to be talking about punks today. I'm Michael Harlan Turkel, the host of The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Here today with David Massoni and John Bush of Thistle Hill Tavern and soon to be open Tall Day Restaurant, both in Park Slope. Talk a little bit about you guys and then get into, you know, the punk scene.
I don't know where he wants to start, but yeah. The story I always like to tell the most is that we have known each other for a long time.
Yeah.
There's lots to that story, but we have been complaining about our bosses for years and years and years and saying, if we ever open our own place, this is how we do things.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, we opened up our own place.
How many people actually follow through with that threat?
Yeah, well, it kind of happened. It was really strange. It was, as I said, it's a long story, but a really crazy path. I was about 2 months away from joining the SFPD Police Academy.
Yeah.
And then my friend Mike was like, I don't want you to be a cop. How about I give you a bunch of money and you open a restaurant?
Right. Yeah. That's a felicitous little moment there.
Yeah, literally. Yeah. I mean, that's almost how it happened.
Yeah. But, I mean, you grew up in California, Santa Cruz, and then spent a whole bunch of time in San Fran working your way through kind of notorious bars.
It's funny. Not so much in San Francisco. I was in San Francisco for about 2.5 years. But I worked at this bar called the Club Deluxe, which was the epicenter of the swing movement, which was just the opposite of everything that I liked.
What is that, like long chain zoot suits
yeah.
and all that?
And
yeah.
like, you know, big band orchestras would come in, this like 18-piece bands would come in and play in this little bar. And then there was like this punk rock kid working there.
Yeah.
You know, just like, why all you people?
Yeah.
You know, you guys are ridiculous. And then, you know,
aren't
like,
you supposed to put yourself in that situation as a punk anyway?
I guess. Yeah. And then they were like going, why does this guy work here?
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. So, what kind of music were you listening to at that time?
At that time, I mean, it was like, you know, I went through the whole punk thing in the 80s and then I went and lived abroad for a long time and I came back. And it was, you know, I was really kind of like, look at me all my through my youth. And then as soon as I hit like 18, 19, I was like, nobody look at me. I want to just be normal. Like,
yeah.
You know, but I mean, like I was always a big fan of like California hardcore, you know,
yeah.
Black Flag. I mean, I was, as much as I hate to admit it to Mike, I was a huge NoFX fan and
yeah.
like, I wasn't really, but yeah. no, I love you guys. And I still unfortunately listen to NoFX pretty much every day when I'm getting up. That's like my, I'm going to go out tonight. I'm going to throw these songs on and get pumped.
Well, we'll talk about NoFX a little bit more later. From punk to food,
the
coalescing of music and cuisine. David, you spent years in restaurants, the Battaglia Empire, working with the Dentons at Enoteca. Where did your food fascination start?
It started with my parents. I come from a very proud Italian father, Italian-American father, who didn't have anybody really pushing cuisine on him, so instead of going for like the Italian-American roots, he actually wanted to always go back to the source and, you know, try to make Italian dishes at home. And as a side project to my mom and dad's career, when I was 14, they bought a hotel and restaurant in Maryland. And so I already had this idea of what good food was supposed to be, and then I had the experience of actually getting to work in it. And every single night go out, you know, and try to put together this, you know, great meal and this great experience for people. You know, it just stuck. I didn't know it was what I was always going to do at the time, but I knew I loved it from day one.
Yeah. When did you come from Maryland to New York?
The place, like I said, was never my mom and dad's career, and they sold it when I was 21. And the day they sold it, I moved to New York. I sold my Mustang and packed up.
I thought
up.
You were going
to
say mustache for a second. No.
Sold my Mustang and packed up everything I had and moved to New York. And I was convinced when I moved to New York in 1996 that I was going to walk into either Danielle, Felidia, or John George, or one of the restaurants of that nature.
You didn't care about last names?
No. and get a job as an assistant manager day one.
Yeah.
And everybody said to this 21-year-old, 22-year-old kid, you know, go out and get some New York City experience and come back and talk to us in a couple of years.
Yeah.
But one of the great people that told me that was Joe Bastianich. And he didn't hire me at Felidia, but he said, go downtown. Go learn downtown. Go to Soho. Go to the Village. Go to the East Village. And try to find a place that's like the type of place that you want to own someday. And work there. And give them your blood, sweat, and tears until you figure out what it is you want to do. And that's kind of what I did.
Yeah. That is so converse of, you know, John working in places that he hated.
That was just one place.
Yeah. And I tell that with a grain of salt. I mean, as much as I hated it, I learned so much there. And I mean, the first thing I learned is how much money you can make bartending. And luckily through bartending, I got so much freedom to do all the traveling I've done or go on tour with bands or get to do what I wanted, but without working all day, every day.
Yeah.
And I've always been a night creature. So that worked out pretty well. And I do like the drink. Unfortunately, I am a fan of the alcohol. Yeah. So it all worked out pretty nice for me.
We both share Irish and Italian roots. So. Yeah.
And it's really funny to me because me and Dave are both half Irish, half Italian, and how much he really grasped onto the Italian side of my family. Yeah. And I really grasp onto the Irish side of my family. So we keep talking. We have all, you can have the Italian. I'll keep all the Irish. All right. And that works out real good.
It's funny, this little tavern's Mediterranean, kind of European or pan-European food.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought of opening up like an Irish-Italian place?
No.
Oh, there it is. Well,
we talk a lot about an Italian place.
Yeah, we talk about an Italian place a lot. Like my dream upon dream that someday, and I know it might take a little while, but I want to open up an old man sports bar. Yeah. Like a place that my dad used to hang out in, you know. But it's classy. I don't want Coors Lights posters on the walls and neon everywhere. I want like that rad 70s, even if I can get like old TVs, I'd do it, you know, and just but have sports on.
Yeah.
And when the game's off, you turn it off. And then it's still just an old dive where you can still get a $4 shot of Cutty Sark.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's his dream, but it's mine too. I mean, it's you know, I think we're going to indulge each other along the road if we're so lucky to be able to keep doing this. And I hope we are, but you know, that is something we want to do desperately. Opening a trattoria someday is something that we both desperately want to do. And
we have a couple other ideas. I don't know if we're going to talk about. We have one really good idea.
Are they restaurant related or are they something that you really can't talk about?
Probably.
It's all restaurant bar. Yeah.
Well, we have one more idea that I think is probably going to be the next one.
Yeah.
I think.
Is that the Dale idea?
Yeah.
Yeah. The three of us sat around one night and It was a great brainstorming session.
Awesome.
Yeah.
But Dale is Dale Talde of
That's right.
Top Chef fame, who you are opening a restaurant with
That's right.
soon. Let's talk about that. It sounded very interesting because it's not your typical just Asian restaurant. It's Asian accents.
Yeah.
And with a chef's table, it's so different from what you have at Thistle Hill.
It is. At the end of the day, the feel and the vibe of the place, we want to be similar to Thistle Hill, and that being a neighborhood joint. Now, it's going to be a neighborhood joint that's got a whole lot of very cool bells and whistles. But to talk about how we got to that cuisine is we just wanted to build a restaurant around Dale.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dale, through a couple of other like brainstorming, you know, ideas of what his menu was going to be and who he is and the mark that he wants to make on the, you know, culinary landscape of New York is I'm an Asian American.
Yeah.
And there's a whole lot of cuisine out there that is, you know, blank American, Italian American, Jewish American. And why can't there be Asian American? Because he's got a very specific viewpoint of being, you know, a first generation Filipino American who sought out to be a chef, wanted to be a chef, wanted to cook. That's all he ever wanted to do. He didn't fall back on it. And he wanted to cook Asian food. And he pretty much sought out every single Asian cuisine that he could work in.
And he loves Frank's hot sauce. So, and you know, you know, it's like, you got to put dishes around things you love.
Yeah.
And he loves American bacon. And he loves Popeye's fried chicken. And he loves, you know, all these things that he grew up with being an American kid.
Yeah. Well, I saw a quote on New York Magazine that he said something about how much he hates the F word. And by that, he meant fusion.
Oh, yeah.
He hates what it has become.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, I completely agree. And hearing your paths and your stories, it's this collective thing of experiences.
And that's what fusion is.
Yeah.
Man. I know.
It's not just...
even it's the same thing whenever, I feel like I'm an old school bartender. And whenever I hear the word like, oh, he's a mixologist, I want to shoot myself. I mean, it's exactly the same thing. But
Tom
I'm just
told
like,
me not to use the word mixologist, but I started to bring up mixologist.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Nothing makes me angrier.
Yeah.
Literally nothing makes me angrier.
Yeah.
And I'll go to places and I go, oh, that's a really good drink. But I just had to wait 20 minutes and it cost me $20.
Yeah.
That's not bartending, damn it.
Yeah. What's your most expensive drink and what's your most complex one that you make?
My most expensive drink is $12, but it's also with top shelf booze. I mean, we're not making a killing off it.
Yeah.
I mean, if it was $20, we'd be making a killing off of it. That would probably be our Thistle Hill cocktail.
Yeah.
And our most complex is actually a drink that I'm pretty proud of, our Howard Hughes. It was a drink called the Aviator.
Yeah.
But I tasted it and I'm like, that's good, but there's something missing. And I just kept messing with it and messing with it. And then all of a sudden I changed the booze. I changed the concept. I think the only thing it still has in it is lemon juice and soda from the original drink. But man, is it good.
I'm a sucker for creme de violette. What did you replace?
Oh, no. I put it
actual chip.
Do I want to tell?
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
It's kind of a secret. Next thing I know, these mixologists are going to steal my drink. These Italian marinated cherries, these brandy cherries.
Yeah.
That fresh mint and a vanilla bitters muddled together. I tried it with vodka at first, and I was like, that's good. And then out of nowhere, I was like, let's try gin. And it just, that was it.
Yeah.
Those two flavors combined so good. That it's a pain in the ass to make.
Yeah,
and at the time we had Aviation Gin, and we knew of this old drink, the Aviator, and Howard Hughes, you know, as the name for it, just you know, was kind of perfect.
Yeah,
I call it the Amelia Earhart with vodka.
Yeah, and all of the bartenders that work for us hate that drink.
Yeah,
because there's a lot to it.
Yeah,
it's the hardest drink to make.
Yeah,
yeah,
and it's the drinks we make
so
the most.
Everybody go to Thistle Hill Tavern, order that cocktail.
Yes,
piss John off a little bit.
John said this is the best drink.
Yeah,
order that. I go, I'm John.
Yeah. A little bit more about your paths. What I find interesting is where was the meeting point? I mean, where did you guys cross?
Yeah, it's a fun story. I mean, my godbrother, if you will, my mom is his godmother, his mom is my godmother, is a guy named Max Huber. And on the music tip, Max was the guitarist for the Swinging Udders. And at 18, moved to California.
Now he's missing the big part. Max got into some trouble.
Yeah.
And his parents sent him to California to go live with his uncle to get him away from the trouble.
Yeah. He got thrown out of like one of the most prestigious private schools in Washington, D.C., and he was totally part of that little punk scene that was happening in D.C. of like Fugazi and you know, Minor Threat, and being a fan of those bands, you know. And he found a little magazine that
me and John my friends made.
We made
a little fanzine.
A little fanzine.
Called Boots and Booze.
Boots and Booze.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. But, he found this magazine, and I don't know, it was a ridiculous magazine. I cannot believe how many people in the world go, oh my God.
I remember that.
You're Little John from Boots and Booze. I'm like, really?
Yeah.
Like, I made that at Kinko's.
Yeah.
He had it. He got it. You know, in our little small world at the time in the '80s,
and they became best friends.
He wrote me a letter.
Yeah,
like, hi, my name is Max. I'm from DC. I just moved here. I don't know anybody. Here's my phone number. I don't have any friends. And I was like, okay, called the dude, and pretty much right away we were like best friends.
Yeah.
I mean, John got married this past weekend, and Max was his best man, and likewise, John was the best man in his wedding. But Max was like my big brother.
Yeah.
Had always been. More than to say he was like a cousin, he was like my big brother. And when he knew that I had moved to New York, we ran into each other at Thanksgiving dinner back home in Maryland, and he said, you know, have you made any friends in New York yet? And I said, you know, Max, I've been so busy working. And he said, well, do yourself a favor. Go to Niagara at the corner of 7 and A, and there should be a bartender there named John Bush. Introduce yourself to him, and, you know, he's going to be a lifelong friend. And he was right. I mean, that was 1996 that I walked into Niagara and introduced myself to John. And, we've been friends ever since. Yeah. And always tried to stay in each other's circle, you know. John had a huge group of friends in the East Village, and I had my restaurant friends. But we were always trying to bring them together. You know, whether it was me going to his bar for free drinks or him coming to the restaurant I was working at for, you know, I'm sure old
cheaper
bosses
food.
Cheaper food. But really, like, riffing off what each other was doing. So much so that, you know, when I went to go open Oto Pizzeria at 1 Fifth Avenue for Mario Batali, John said, do you have room for, like, a part-time bartender 2 days, 3 days a week? I want to learn restaurant bartending, and I want to learn more about wine, and I want to learn more about food. And John,
which
was
I
one,
did.
Yeah, and John
I
was
still
one.
Only drink Italian wine.
Yeah.
And John was one of the opening bartenders working with our old friend Dennis Mullally. But, you know, over the years, we talk about, like, as John started this, you know, the bosses that we didn't like, or the way things were done in places that we would have done better, and
Things wrong, dirty bathroom, bad bathrooms. I swear to God, that's where it started. I still, to this day, even before we ever opened a restaurant in my life or thought about opening a restaurant, I would go into a place and I'd walk into the bathroom and I'd go, I like this place.
Yeah.
It literally was the bath. It was all about the bathroom. And it still is. I still walk into a place and I go, look at the bathroom. I go, ooh, good job.
How's the bathroom at Thistle
Hall? Oh, it's immaculate.
Yeah.
And cool,
sleep
too.
On the floor.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's that good.
People come out and they're like, wow, you guys put a lot of attention into the bathroom. Yeah, and that goes to, you know, as far as, like, you know, what we started realizing that each other liked so many of the same things. We had never talked about opening a bar or restaurant together, yet anytime we'd be out, it would be, one of us would come out of, and we got to get out of the bathroom here, but one of us would come out of the bathroom and be like, did you see their soap, you know, dispenser?
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
No, what does it look like? Go look at it.
Or just sit there, you know, at the bar feeling the wood, go, ooh, this is a
really nice.
I like the way that they did this in the bar. Oh, look at that bucket.
Yeah.
So you look guys, where they put their tap. Oh, that's this place is, like, these people are smart.
I think I make those mental notes. I check for hooks underneath every bar.
Totally.
Oh, my God.
100%.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't have hooks,
you blew it.
I'll never come back.
Yeah.
No, exactly.
You blew it.
Got one drink and I'm out of there. So, I mean, the restaurant also seems like, to me, if you didn't do that, you guys would be like bath remodelers.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe.
We're going to take a quick break and come right back. But I want to talk about Niagara, because it's a place I think I've been to a lot of times. And I stress, I think.
Well, if I threw you out, I apologize.
Yeah. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back.
His liver exploded. Now what's Bob going to do now that he can't drink? The doctor said, what you been thinking? Bob said, that's the point. I won't think about nothing. Now I gotta do something else.
Hi, hi, hi.
I passed the time and someone shaving. Then he got a new identity. 62 old air cushion boots and a girl who rides a scooter to take him out of town. They would get away. Riding around as the trucks drive by, you can hear the
And we're back, the food scene on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, here today with Dave Massoni and John Bush from Thistle Hill Tavern. And we just listened to No Effects' Bob. Fat Mike, No Effects, is actually a proprietor of Thistle Hill Tavern. And you said you have a funny story about that song.
I have a funny story. They were out here for my wedding. Me and Mike have been really close for a long time, and he was talking about, oh, we got to do, you know, No Effects are going to start doing a new record. I've been doing some writing and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I've been part of No Effects family for a long time. And they're like, you know, it's been kind of weird trying to write new records. I'm like, well, write another song about me. That's what I'm talking about. Like, let's bring it back to me. I like it when you do stuff. And he's like, you already got two. I'm like, well, how about you do this? Because, you know, I'm getting older. My body's kind of starting to hurt. Like, one of these days, my doctor's going to tell me I have to quit drinking. I'm getting nervous about that day. I'm trying to, and I was like, what you should do is just rewrite Bob and just change it to John. Same lyrics, but just John, call it John. And he's like, I might do that.
Yeah.
I might just do that.
Just a Mad Lib app that someone can just say their name in that song.
Exactly.
It wouldn't be too bad.
I'm telling you.
What two No Effects songs are about you?
Well, there's My Friend in New York, which is it's a side B of the 45 collection. I don't know how many people know or got that. And then Cruel and Unusual Punishment is written about a night that me and Mike had in Tokyo. It was of the AM. Listen to the lyrics, and you'll know what I'm talking about.
Awesome.
But I was there, and it's led Mike onto a new lifestyle.
Yes.
I'm going to have to go and re-listen to that. But I want to get back to Niagara, because Niagara was a really cool place. I mean, it still is.
It was
an epicenter of everything.
It was everything. Yeah.
For 10 years, it was Niagara was a mecca. I mean, I would say the first 5 years that we were open, I mean, God, probably more than that, every single rock band that played in New York, after party. I mean, like, for no joke. For a solid 6-7 years, it was like, you know, I mean, everything from Kiss would come in and Ace Frehley would come by after the show. And he would love it because he'd sit at the bar and have no makeup on and nobody would know who he was. And my two bosses would be losing their mind going, he doesn't pay for anything, you know? And I'd be like, who is that?
One of the beauties also about Niagara, and only if you were there did you know, when those gates came down, they literally blocked out every single solitary ounce of sunlight.
Well, there was the mail slot.
Yeah.
So when the mail slot could keep going.
And it did.
It did. Like, you know, I worked there for 13 years. And, like, I full time for 13 years. And, you know, the owners there were just great to me. They really let me come and go. And, you know, when I left, they gave me my favorite Bob Gruen framed picture of the Clash 85 Boston Arena. Like, my favorite photo. And they're like, you know, I can't give you a gold watch, but we're going to give you this picture.
Well, that's what's so cool about it, too. It's a reliquary with all that imagery on the wall of, you know, the better musical times.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, it's as much as I still love New York and it's the East Village has turned into the reason I opened a place in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Because Brooklyn reminds me a little bit of the old New York. It reminds me a little bit of Santa Cruz. It's like a community. It's like, I mean, when I worked at Niagara first opened up, I knew everybody on the block. I would say hi to the bodega guy. I knew everybody on every restaurant. I knew every bartender on the block. It was felt more of a community, and that's exactly how Thistle Hill and 7th Avenue feels to me again, where I know I walk down this, I get off the train, hey, how are you? Shaking hands, kissing babies. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, how do you find Park Slope? It's funny because, Dave, you were saying that you actually lived in an apartment a couple blocks from Roberta's back in the mid to late 90s.
Yeah, 98 to 2000, and this neighborhood was really scary.
Yeah.
Really scary. But the entire time that I've lived in New York, it's always been Brooklyn. When my wife and I got together, she had the cheaper apartment in Astoria, so I did about 9 months in Astoria. But other than that, it was always Brooklyn. And for the most part, other than 2 years here in Bushwick, it was always Park Slope. Mm-hmm. My brother and I lived together for 6 years in Park Slope. I started out in Park Slope. And my wife and I have been in Park Slope now for about 6 years, five years. It feels like home. One of the things somebody said to me early on when I first moved to New York was, people that move to New York from somewhere else to try to make it their home and move to Manhattan are always talking about when they're going to leave.
Yeah.
And people that move to New York from somewhere else and move to Brooklyn are never talking about leaving. And that's how it was for me.
Yeah.
So.
And you had this neighborhood in your heart.
Mm-hmm.
But you had to bring a lot into this restaurant.
Sure.
Too. And
I had to convince Rebecca Weitzman, our chef partner, to come out.
Oh, I'll never forget when you took me out the first time. I was like, I really like the space of Park Slope.
And John lived in Williamsburg, so and everything was about Williamsburg. You know? Williamsburg was white hot. You know, that's where you have to open a restaurant. And it still is. But one of our things was, do we really want to go through the headaches of trying to get a liquor license in Williamsburg? Do we, you know, one of the reasons why we're moving away from Manhattan is because, you know, the oversaturation and that, you know, you're starting to see that a little bit on the streets in Williamsburg, and Park Slope just felt right.
Well, it was the location. I mean, it, I don't know if you've seen our place.
Oh, but, that corner. Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, I remember, it was
Olive Vine, right?
Yeah. I mean, I still look at it and I'm in love with that, the location. Yeah. I love our place. I look at it like I want to lie and kiss the floors and kiss the walls.
The bathroom floor, too.
I could live in there. Yeah. I mean, I could, and I'd probably be cleaner. But, I was never so happy to be wrong in my life than making the decision to open up in Park Slope. I mean, I really, really like the people. Yeah.
So
I'm just going to get on one point, because John just said something that I think is the reason why we've been great partners so far, is because we don't care when we're wrong with each other.
Yeah.
Because if I'm wrong, then that means he's right. And vice versa, you know, and neither one of us have an ego about that with each other. Other people, different story.
Is that why you guys chose not to go with designers and build a restaurant yourselves?
Well, I mean,
we don't have the money for designers.
Designers, how much do they cost?
Yeah. Right.
Necessity is the mother of invention, you know? And it also goes back to the thing that we were saying before, you know, we've been talking about other people's design forever, before we ever knew we were going to do this. And the idea of, can we do this? Can we design it? We can, can't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, we know what we like, you know?
Well, I mean, just on the pure fact, I mean, early on at Thistle Hill, we were both just like, I want to make a place that looks like it's always been here.
Yeah.
I mean, that was me and him were on point there. And then I still haven't read it, but you said that the Zagat guy thing said, you know, this place has been here for a year and a half, you know.
But it feels like it's been there forever.
Yeah, but it feels like it's been here forever. Yeah. I was just like, yes, exactly, you know, like old. I hope it's there forever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I hope it's there for the next. I hope I'm dead and buried in the bathroom. I don't know. I hope it's there forever, because it's amazing.
Because that's what we tried to make it look like, is that it should be there forever.
And it's the perfect size, and it's just a beautiful place.
Well, a lot of the materials, too, are older. It's not new construction. You went upstate and salvaged for a while.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we salvaged some stuff, and then, like, we found, like, our walls were literally 6 inches of plaster and then a fake brick wall. And we're like, what? And we, on both sides, and we tore them both down, and there's these beautiful brick walls.
Our exposed brick wall was covered with a faux brick wall.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's, you know, the 60s and 70s were a bad time in New York, obviously.
Yeah.
But, and then, you know, our floor was this awful green tile that was terrible. And then we tore a wall down, and we saw this beautiful, and we have the most beautiful wood floors. It's like, we like just found it and really pump life back into this beautiful location.
I'm still waiting for someone in Brooklyn to, you know, tear down the faux and, you know, rip up the floor and find that Indiana Jones Ark of the Covenant thing going on.
It might happen.
Like Templar,
You'd be digging out of the basement one day and find a bag of silver.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the cool things, though, about like turning these spaces back into something, and it's what we've done with Taldi as well, and it came from a little bit of our own knowledge of what the neighborhood was like. But since we've opened Thistle Hill, all these old timers from the neighborhood have come in and told us, one, you did a great job, but do you know what used to be here?
Oh, yeah. The history is pretty amazing.
What used to be there?
Well, before televisions, before everybody had a TV at home, and this wasn't just Brooklyn, but definitely that's the neighborhood we're in. Every single corner from Greenwood Cemetery to Flatbush Avenue and 7th Avenue had at least one bar. Every corner. And it was because that's all there was to do at night. You'd get out of work, go home, eat dinner with the wife and kids, and then go to the corner bar.
Or it was really like the Irish English vibe, where it was like you took the family out on Friday and Saturday night, you ate, but your dad stayed and got drunk.
Yeah.
And our space at Thistle Hill had been, when the building was first built, it was a bar, a watering hole. There was an Irish couple that owned it. And then when the husband died, the wife tried to keep it going, and there was a gang in the neighborhood called the Tigers, and they were the Irish gang.
Yeah.
And this was in the 50s.
Yeah, they were the only gang with pistols. Yeah. That was the word on the
street. I was going to say, because there are so many tigers in Ireland.
Yeah, right.
That makes sense. You
know, well, they took it over, and it was their social club for a while. And then it became a store, and then it became something else, and then it became the Olive Vine.
No, it was a bar in the 80s. Yeah. Remember, we found that. That stone.
Mamondo's or something like that.
Mamondo's bar. And supposedly the guy was a crazy person. He lived in the basement.
Yeah.
And he bartended upstairs, which actually kind of sounds nice to me. You know?
And then when we started doing Taldi, another corner on 7th Avenue, somebody said to me, who came, another old-timer that came in for lunch, said, you know that space that you took is Radigan's. And I said, Radigan's. And she was like, you know Pete Hamill's book, A Drinking Life?
Oh, really?
And... It was. Pete Hamill's book, A Drinking Life, was his memoir, and it was his memoir about growing up on 7th Avenue and his dad's watering hole, his dad's local, where Pete, as a young man, learned to drink, was our space.
Yeah.
And it was called Radigan's. And so
I just knew it as a dry cleaner when I lived over there.
Yeah. It was a dry cleaner for almost 30 years.
The dry cleaner of all time.
Yeah,
I would sit in there and just watch the shirts go up on that rack and see how long it took
for yours to get down.
Yeah.
I just remember they had the giant fish. They still have it. I'm trying to buy it.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, I need that for a back bar somewhere at some time.
Yeah. This idea of local, you know, everyone pushes forward local, sustainable. But there is another thing about local. Where it is involving and bringing the locals in to make it feel like a neighborhood rather than just preaching about those values. And it sounds like you guys have really accomplished that.
And that's not always the easiest thing either. And I don't mean to accomplish it, but to keep that going. Because one of the things that we really preached to the staff when we opened and things took off the way they did at Thistle Hill was, guys, you need to realize that the community is going to think of this place as theirs.
Yep.
And we want them to. And that's not always easy, you know, from a service standpoint. We want people to feel so comfortable that they think of Thistle Hill as their place. And they do. And one of the things that's nice about that is, you know, we're really happy to share it with them. You know, John and I joke about the fact that just since we started construction there, we're watching kids grow up.
Yeah.
You know, kids that come in with their families, we're watching them grow up.
We're seeing dads that came in. I mean, more than one have came in and been like, I just had a child. And I'm like, oh, man.
Buy you a shot.
Shot's on me.
Yeah.
And now he's coming in with that kid. Now that kid's talking and walking and being loud. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you going to be Uncle John to a lot?
I'd love to be a good uncle.
Yeah.
I love it. I love the kids.
Yeah.
Wait, I take that back. I love other people's kids.
Yeah. This space, also being this local, you know, watering hole, also have this ethos about local sustainable food.
Sure.
I'm sure from your years in Batali and, you know, with the Dentons, that helped. But you also spent a lot of time in Italy.
Yeah, I spent almost a year living in Italy for one stretch. But also my mom and dad have been taking me and my brother and sister to Italy for, you know, family vacations and summer trips. And I've always had a huge, you know, love for everything Italian. But that year of living there really made me see how, you know, sustainability has been practiced for eons, you know, because it was the only way to do it, not because it was cool or it was a movement. It just makes sense on so many different levels. And it's something that our partner Rebecca believes in. It's something that our partner Dale believes in. And it's something that we believe in. And, you know, just 2 years ago, front of house guys didn't really have a chance to make their mark on the whole local sustainable movement. You know, everything came from either Southern or Empire or something like that. We now get gin dropped off by local gin makers. We now get bitters made by, you know, and they're hard to track down.
Whiskey,
and,
you know, we're out of your stuff.
We're out. You need to bring us more.
He's out.
Like, I'm out. I'm trying to make more. But that's now a chance for front of house guys to start making their mark too. And, you know,
and people order it. I mean, that's the thing that I get really excited about is, you know, I have a drink called the Brooklyn Gin and Tonic, and it's made with the Brooklyn gin, and it's made with Q Tonic that's made here in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And it's one of them, and it says it on the menu, and it's one of the most popular drinks. It's
well,
like,
and people walk up to the bar and never ask, what beers do you have on draft? They say, what are your local drafts?
Yeah.
Yeah. You really see it. Like, people love to be from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And eat and drink stuff from Brooklyn.
And we and took that to the building side, too, when we were building Thistle, and as we're in the finishing stages of construction on Taldy now, any chance that we've ever had to keep it local, from needing new glass for windows, let's use a local guy, you know, from ironwork, metalwork, wood, anything that we could buy local, we did, you know. When I worked in Manhattan, White Plains Linen was the big linen company to use. Well, Arrow Linen is three blocks from us. It was a no-brainer. That's who we're using, you know. Any chance that we can get to buy something from somebody that's another Brooklyn business person, you know, we do. And not because it's cool, but just because it just feels the right thing to do.
Well, and it builds on the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And you also build relationships with these people. And it's like they're working their asses off just like we are. And hopefully someday we're all going to be rich and going, those guys are good guys. They, you know, they're with us from the beginning.
Yeah.
And we'll be like, we've been with them for years. You know. So, like, I want that to happen. I want to have that history. I like that.
Yeah.
As much as I hate using the word old school, it's old school.
It is old school.
Bring it back.
Yeah. Old school's the new.
Is the new school.
Right? Yeah.
Old school. And
yeah.
I love that movie. I love you, Dad.
Which? Oh. I wanted to get back to a little bit about how you've become better bosses. Because you were talking about how, you know, you saw how other restaurants did it and you complained about other bosses. What have you changed in yourselves to manage a better staff?
We're an incredible parenting
team.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm the woman.
Yes. John is mom, I'm dad. As far as our relationship to our staff.
Yeah.
And that just kind of happened naturally. It wasn't anything we decided on. I've just been managing people longer. And I come from a very strict father. And John is, you know, the only child of a single hippie mom. So it kind of all just worked out that way.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, and it's something we both believe, is keep your staff as happy as humanly possible.
At least I do that.
Yeah. But you know, in any way that you can. You know, if somebody's having a hard time with their boyfriend or girlfriend, take the night off, you know, or you've got a smaller section tonight and everyone else has to run a little bit harder, or, somebody needs to buy, a confirmation dress for their daughter, you know, like, all right, we'll pay for it, you know, and, you know, we take that from our dishwashers to our managers to our cooks to our other bartenders. You know, anything we can do to make your life a little bit easier has to, in our minds, translate to you're going to take care of our customers
better. Yeah.
And it's not that hard.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that I've always had complaints with owners sometimes is it's like something that would be, you know, so small but would make my life so much easier. Why aren't you doing this? Like, you know, I need the day off. Can't have the day off.
But why? Just because I can't?
Just because it's like a power play. And I don't think we do that. Like, I'm making a decision because that's my decision. It might not be the right decision, but it's my decision. I don't think we do that very often.
Yeah. And we've always tried to keep an open door policy of allowing our staff to feel like they can come and tell us when we're wrong, when they think that when they disagree or they see another way to do it than the way that we're doing it. And sometimes we'll say no, you know, we've worked our butts off to get where we are and we're going to do it this way or no way. But for the most part, we listen to them and find out what viewpoint they have and empower them sometimes too, you know, from the standpoint of there's no way I can know all of our regular customers. Charlie knows a group of regular customers. Stacy knows a group of regular customers. Bethany knows a group of regular customers. Bobby, and we empower them to say, you know what, this person's been in three times this week. You know, let's do something nice for them, you know, and it works.
Wow, so trust
is
in restaurants?
Well, it happens.
It can be.
Yeah.
It can be.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I he definitely went through the corporate restaurant, and I went through working for friends for a long time. And, you know, I think it's a double-edged sword. Sometimes working for your friends is a lot better, and you can count and trust. And then sometimes working for your friends is rough on both of you. I think that since we both did both the ways we did it, it makes us better partners and better bosses. Because there's plenty of times I'll just be like, no, dude. Like,
yeah,
you don't talk to me like that. I got this. And then, or you got that. Like, I don't want to talk to that person.
Yeah.
And he's this aunt right there, you know?
Yeah.
It works really well.
So what's kind of awesome is you walk in a Thistle Hill Tavern, and this is not a play. I mean, this is real.
Yeah.
What you're hearing, these attitudes, this you know, jubilance put forth, happens there as well. So if you've not been to Thistle Hill Tavern, go. Talde opening up in November.
Yep.
Go check out the neighborhood, which you guys are really help nurturing.
I'll make you a great drink.
Yeah.
Yes.
And drink it with you.
Excellent. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Dave Masoni, John Bush, Thistle Hill Tavern, Talde. Check them out. Have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following message has been brought to you by Taste Brooklyn. Our city's finest chefs partner with farmers and local vineyards next to the Green Market for an extraordinary outdoor culinary festival. Try exquisite delicacies using locally grown seasonal delights on the plaza outside Brooklyn's Borough Hall. Top chefs and artisans will offer sumptuous fare paired with premium wines, all to empower our neediest children to get healthy. The mighty FDNY and DSNY harbor their own culinary masters in uniform. They will cook off against the pros. Sample delicious cuisine without stressing over a reservation while supporting a worthy cause. Taste Brooklyn's Field to Fork Outdoor Culinary Festival, Saturday, October 15th, 2011, from 11:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Learn more and buy tickets at tastesofbrooklyn.blogspot.com. That's TASTESOF Brooklyn.blogspot.com.